morning. No, good morning. Good afternoon. Terrible Tommy here, right here in the bunker as usual. And it's the 25th of October, 2017, and we're getting pretty close to Halloween. Yeah, pretty close. What do you think of a few people to put on your list to go out and boo them? Yeah, right. Boy, politics are getting interesting. Politics are getting interesting. These Republicans are quitting the party, quitting the office, and all that kind of stuff. The Democrats are snitching on each other. I'm telling you, everything's looking good to me. I think things look wonderful. Well, today I'm going to bring you an article out of our newspaper. Yeah, out of our newspaper that we produced for, 25 years? And let's see here. What was the date on this newspaper? What the hell is it? I don't have the front page here. Just a minute. Let me see. Okay, it's August 2004 is this issue of the War Paper. We had a really nice article here about who was George Lincoln Rockwell. By A.V. Scharfenberg. He wrote some good articles for us. I don't know whatever happened to him. I think he was a POW. 10,000 incensed Jews swarmed into New York City's Central Park, where the man they hated most planned to speak in the Freeform area. The huge mob was swollen with overwrought people loudly screaming for his blood. They brandished lead pipes and pieces of broken pavement in the best Old Testament traditions of free speech. No one really expected him to show up in the face of such demented numbers, so the frothing chosen turned the event into an anti-Nazi celebration. They clapped and sang, Havaligia, Havagan. I can't pronounce that damn word, unless I've had a couple of drinks. And performed round dances in the street. But at the height of their vengeful hysteria, at the appointed time, a big man standing tall and alone in the very midst of the insane rabble, threw off his long, concealed overcoat. As if by black magic, George Lincoln Rockwell appeared in full stormtrooper uniform, in the eye of an emotional hurricane, surrounded by enemies. Too stunned to move, incredibly, he began to taunt them, deriding them to their camel faces as cowards and fugitives from the lunatic asylums. He had shown up, he said, at their request, so let's see how tough they really were. No one made a move against the formidable ex-U.S. Navy commander. He strutted smiling among them, ridiculing their false promises to prevent his New York speech. It was a very personal confrontation between the Aryan man and his Jewish opposites, between racial matter and antimatter. An explosion was inevitable. The Jews go nuts. Only by degrees did the Hebes belatedly psych themselves up to a sufficient hysteria. In a convulsive, screaming lunge, they fell on Commander Rockwell, but he had the psychological advantage of the larger-than-life personal courage. In an utterly one-sided battle, too incredible for anyone who has not actually witnessed or fought through such a moment, he bashed and throttled his way into the shrieking crowd. The grasping, spitting devils fell on all sides. As the lone hero of the white race cut a path of blood and broken bones across New York City. They never knocked him off his feet, and he never tired of splitting enemy jaws. Alarmed and inspired by such Herculean bravery, a squad of policemen crashed into the howling throng, swinging nightsticks. Kosher casualties mounted rapidly as the cops obviously relished their sport. They blazed a path of splattering gore to the ever-battling Rockwell and escorted him over the blubbering bodies of fallen Jews. He emerged with only a few cuts and minor bruises. Even his uniform was relatively good shape. The commander's early life, George Lincoln Rockwell, had come a long way from his birthplace in central Illinois. On March 9, 1918, to be sure his youth was far removed from the battlefields of New York City, he yearned to become a successful commercial artist, an ambition fulfilled when he won first prize in a national competition for the Cancer Foundation. But the Second World War changed his plans forever. Volunteering as a U.S. Navy pilot even before the America's official entry into the conflict. He was persuaded to believe with millions of other betrayed Americans that Adolf Hitler was getting ready to take over Coney Island and the Statue of Liberty, decorated by war's end for combat duty against German U-boats. He re-enlisted for the Korean War, rising to the rank of commander while stationed in Iceland. He met and married a beautiful Nordic woman with whom he raised a family in the 50s. But since the end of World War II, Rockwell had grown increasingly troubled by the deteriorating condition of Western civilization, the antidote for which he finally discovered in Mein Kampf. Aware at last of his real destiny, he founded the American Nazi Party, fulfilling the prophecy the Führer made shortly before his death. Quote, the fight against the Jews will not be renewed first in Europe, but in the United States. Within 25 years, the Americans will have begun to come to their senses about the Jewish question, unquote. The fight renewed, but in 1958, the American people were too complacent and self-satisfied for white revolution. The Nigger riots, economic chaos, cultural rot, and the Vietnam-era treason of the 60s still lay before them. In spite of Gentile apathy, Rockwell's activism blasted through their consciousness through the paper curtain as he referred to the Jewish boycott in the news media of all information about National Socialism. Years of unrewarded sacrifice finally bore fruit with black demonstrations into the Midwestern white working-class neighborhoods. Riding the crest of popular resentment against forced integration, Commander Rockwell addressed large assemblies of fellow white Americans, who for the first time showered him with gratitude he deserved. Quote, the Jews are through in 72, unquote, an often repeated slogan of the times. Represented the high hopes then expressed for his bid for the presidency of the United States. Rockwell's popularity near the close of the decade was such that he seemed bound to win the highest seat in the land someday. That tragically was also the consensus of the Jew system, and he was assassinated under circumstances still shrouded in mystery in Arlington, Virginia. Destiny certainly chose the ideal man to represent the post-war National Socialist movement. 6'4" tall, rugged, handsome, athletic, alert, and quick-witted. He was the quintessential American folk hero in the same mold, physically at any rate, as John Wayne or Clark Gable, with a similar charismatic appeal the American soul most responds to. Indeed, to some observers, he resembled a cross between James Garner and Thyroxus Rex, particularly when in combat. Yet, for all his dynamism, he was a doting father figure and absolutely a loyal friend in the highest traditions of the National Socialist leadership. He constantly hurled himself unhesitatingly among the enemy, who never failed to outnumber him. When the first Viet Cong flag was publicly paraded by a Yiddish communist through the streets of Boston in 1956, Rockwell launched himself into the Marxist demonstration of traitors and fools to tear it down and go to jail for the kind of selfless patriotism no one else dared. As he said modestly of himself on such occasions, he was only trying to undo it in a small way the damage he had done to the National Socialism as a deceived American. World War II. The enemies of the white race would like to pretend that George Lincoln Rockwell never existed, and that includes much of the leadership of the right wing of that day and even today. Certainly, they have done everything possible to expunge his name from American history, but their efforts continue to fail. His image and deeds are forever engraved in the hearts and memories of millions who lived through the turbulent decade of the 60s. His writings and recorded spoken words continue to educate and inspire new generations of racial patriots. Not alt-righters, not nationalists, but racial patriots. Much as we mourn his passing, even after 25 years, we know he did not die before his time, as does no man. It is, after all, the fate of the greatest heroes not to die peacefully in old age, but to fall in their prime under the hatred of their enemies. Only in this manner may they live on forever in the folkish consciousness of our race. George Lincoln Rockwell made every living National Socialist and those yet unborn incomparably rich for his having lived. He single-handedly lifted our banner from the ashes of Berlin into the skies of America. He represented our idea in so personable and professional and winning fashion, he made us proud to be part of his struggle. We are honored to accept his legacy. In his name, sanctified by the blood and sacrifice, we shall use it to the fullest advantage. A man's life is his noblest work, and if his work is carried on by those who survive him, he is not truly dead. Through us, Rockwell lives. George Lincoln Rockwell's works. Our spiritual leader, George Lincoln Rockwell, has laid down the blueprint for us to follow to success, if we will only have the courage to do so. Quote, we must have an all-white America, an America in which our children and our grandchildren will play and go to school. Go to school with other white children. An America in which they will date and marry other young people of their own race. An America in which all of their offspring will be beautifully healthy white babies, never race-mixed mongrels. We must have an America without swarming black filth in our schools, on our buses, and in our places of work. An America in which our cultural, social, and business and political life is free of alien Jewish influence. An America in which white people are the sole masters of our destiny. And that's the end of that. That was a nice article, great article. And even though there are areas where I would probably disagree with some of the tactics and operations of George Lincoln Rockwell, I give him total respect as an Aryan leader. I do that, and I hope you do too. Next time you run into one of these alt-righters, this new breed, ask them what they think of George Lincoln Rockwell. And I would lay money that they will condemn him, as they did at the time when he was trying to operate, trying to influence the right-wing conservatives. He did not achieve that goal because he was a competitor and they hated his guts. That's the story. Some of those right-wing phonies tried to even deny that Patler killed him, shot him. They tried real hard to do that, to their utter shame, and to the utter shame that he was not avenged. That's the saddest part of the struggle. The many people who have given their lives and they have not been avenged. I did not personally know George Lincoln Rockwell. I was not quite up to the racial position I became later. And I knew his exploits, and I knew a lot of his men that marched with him, and I a lot of several of his men that marched with him marched with me later on in my organization or whatever you want to call it. So anyhow, it took me quite a while to get into the racial stride of things. I had to go through the John Birch Society and the conservative thing and the Goldwater campaign, all that nonsense. But sometimes you have to go through all this kind of stuff, sort of like climbing a pyramid, a block at a time. In fact, every major altercation or riot I was in, there was always Rockwell men with me, so I guess we were together in spirit. Well, I reached into my grab bag again, and not knowing what I'm going to pull out, because it's just a whole lot of tapes. And guess what? I found one with at least the partial speech of Robert Miles, Pastor Robert Miles from Michigan, one of the architects of, if there was such a thing, of the times of the order during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Robert Miles was a key player. Robert Miles and I and Richard Butler were subpoenaed to federal grand juries on two occasions in San Francisco, and we were all three went in there and we were out in about 2 minutes because we would not talk and we would only give our name and address. And we had a good time getting together because I was living in California and Miles was living in Michigan and Butler was living in Idaho. So we're happy that the federal government helped us get together for a couple of days. The only difference was that Robert Miles and Tom Metzger just took the fifth period, and Dick Butler, being a very staunch identity Christian preacher, tried to start giving the whole theology of identity to the federal grand jury, which I'm sure fell totally on deaf ears. But anyhow, he did not talk about anything political.
We have the robes and the uniforms, and we portray what once was in hopes that it will be again. That's acting. We're actors in that. That's the racial guerrilla theater. It's needed. But the actor cannot confuse his role as an actor with the reality of the role that he imparts to the audience. I can't go on the stage and pose as a Foreign Legion soldier. And I go through the role and I shoot at Arabs on the stage. Somebody in the audience goes home and they say, boy, that's the kind of people we need, Foreign Legion soldiers to shoot Arabs. And they go home and they find four Lebanese breaking into the back room. So he dials the theater right away. He says, send me those legionnaires. There's four Arab burglars here. The theater will tell him, go see a doctor. We have the same thing, though. We have ones who confuse being an actor to inspire, to teach, to educate, with the actual role. The third factor, the third facet of resistance to us is theological. Because one of the greatest enemies the white race has in this country today is the institutionalized Christian church. It is the whore of Babylon. It was founded by the one we call Satanel's agent. And to us, Satanel is Satan, with the term El added because of his power beyond this earth. And you have two ways of countering the power of Satan's churches. One, by staying in your church and becoming a teacher and an agent within that church and undoing what the pastor or the priest does. That's a hard role because you're going to be a loner. Go to the next Human Relations Day that your church has, Protestant or Catholic or whatever. And after Sambo gets up with his hairstyle and, you'll ask for white power, ask for black power, brother. And everybody, oh, that's nice. You stand up and say, and I'm for white power. And watch everybody move away. You have the whole pew to yourself. They won't even pass the collection plate near you. When you go out the door, the minister or the priest will tell you, look, don't come back here. You're not welcome. So the second option is to go to churches that teach Christianity the way it was taught before the whore took over. And that's the old religion. That's the religion back to the days of Jesus' teaching, not what others said he taught. Build within the church and fight within the church, or leave the church and go where you're comfortable and build that church with that minister and that congregation. What white racist can sit in the average institutionalized church of today, knowing he believes in his race, knowing he believes that his father was the first white man ever, because that's what God is, and be comfortable at the pap and garbage that's fed to you in those churches? That's the third part of the resistance. The racial legal party, the racial guerrilla theater, and the racial theological mission all culminate in the armed party. And the armed party comes. But you're not in that group. Defense forces, to make sure you can have a meeting that's uninterrupted, is not the armed party. Defense forces that protect your women and your children at picnics and rallies, that's not the armed party. When the armed party comes, you will not know who is in it. And anyone who tells you that he is in it is a liar. But you will know it's here by what it does, not what it prints, not what's said about it or anything else. And so we found the third era, the Klan, coming to this end with the Wallace candidacy, the Klan supporting it, the Klan working for it. And that was the end of that period of police political Klan era. Following that period, which ended about 1972, we had the advent of the short-lived fourth era Klan, the TV Klan. It was designed primarily to gain wide publicity for the views of white people concerned with their race. It had good leaders, well-intentioned leaders, hard-working leaders, but they succumbed to the mesmerism of television. They confused publicity with public approval. They confused the role of the Klan with the role that the TV writers gave to the Klan. And we've seen them all, and some of them are good. We've seen David Duke, young, promising, a lot on the ball, and I met him before I went into prison on Stone Mountain in 1973. But the headiness of all this public attention, all this glamour that TV can thrust upon a young person, was too much. We saw him promoted by the TV networks. We saw numbers of people come to him. But he was an actor, a good actor. He was a supreme PR man. He would have made the racial guerrilla theater the most effective propaganda vehicle we had. But you can't confuse the theater with reality. You can't call the Foreign Legion actor to put out the fire in your bedroom that the Arabs have just set. Jews posing as Arabs. I don't want to offend the Arabs. You know what I mean? You have this confusion in roles. David did a lot. He gave a lot. And he still will one of these days. But then you had the FBI move in on that, and they capitalized on that with the Wilkerson operation. Anyone here hasn't seen the reports and the files on the operation of the Wilkerson Klan, then I don't know where you've been. Because I have personal letters from guys in prison who were suckered into situations that they couldn't get out of, and testified against by the ones that were supposedly their leaders. I have a letter at home from a woman, a grandmother, convicted of crimes that were instigated, talked about, never performed, and for which one of the Wilkerson people was paid $4,000. That's not a Klan. That's what we used to call in the white Russian circles a Magnitsk. A Magnitsk is a group that you form to pull out of the docile population that's restless those elements that are most likely to be a threat. and the old Cheka or the NKVD or KGB is a master at it, because they would drop agents into sections of the Ukraine, for instance, posing as Ukrainian nationals, posing as activists, and they would gather together other activists until one night, when they're at the point where they were all set to go, in would come a police regiment, and that was the end of that organization. The TV Klan period suffered because of this. You now see that Klan dying. That Klan era, thank God, is coming to an end. You'll get no publicity from your enemy that serves you, but you'll get all kinds of publicity that will hurt you. I'm past my time, and I'm going to close it up in a few minutes. But I want you to understand why we had these four periods, why we had these four eras. It isn't just the Klan. It's the racial resistance movement we're talking about. There are other organizations that had problems. But I was a Klan leader. I was the national chaplain of the United Klans of America, so I can speak about what our problems in our own house were. I can't about anyone else's organization, and I wouldn't. But I will say this to you. The Klan lives, thrives, grows, dies down. It comes back up again. There is a fifth era coming, and you will see it, because we believe that the last days are upon us, that the war is inevitable between Russia and the United States, not over ideological differences. You are passengers on stagecoaches going down the highway, and you're battling each other over which gang of stagecoach robbers up ahead should rob the stage. And if they rob the stage, it doesn't matter which gang robs the stage, you're going to be the victim. The only fight between the USA and the USSR at top level today is over who is going to be the granddaddy thief of the new world. They can't afford race, because that causes them problems. They sure can't afford to have any gods in front of them other than their own state. They can't afford you to use your own free will, because you might throw them in the sea. In the end, there will be no difference. No matter which of those two sides wins, you're going to have to fight anyway. Whether the war is an instant nuclear war, as some of us believe, and as Colonel Scorzani told us in 1961, would come to pass. Whether it's that three-day special war with strikes back and forth, and then let's go to the UN and talk about it. That's a terror war. The terror war started in 1971 in reality. That's the day the KGB, or the year the KGB decided they didn't care what you believed in, as long as you would destabilize the West. You could be a Nazi, we'll finance you. You could be a Klan group, we'll take care of you, as long as you destabilize whatever country you're working in. That was the declaration of the terror war. The last military war you've seen is World War II, because Korea and Vietnam were limited political police action. There were limited objectives agreed upon in advance. The terror war is the war for keeps. Russians don't want the United States' technical knowledge. They'll steal it if they can. It's cheaper than building their own. They see the United States as the breadbasket of the world. From the Chesapeake Bay to Boston Bay, write it off. The Chicago area, 35 miles either way from dead center in that lake, and then head northwest from there, northeast from there, write that off. New Orleans and the Delta area, 35 miles wide and northeast from there, write that immediate area off. And what have you wiped out? You take Los Angeles and Seattle as the extra targets. And there won't be any other targets. That's where they're going to throw them. But the breadbasket, the food-producing areas are untouched. Whether you like it or not, you are the future farmers of America if the Soviets have their way. You kiss the rest of this stuff goodbye. And the first ones back to pick the beans are going to be the niggers that are left. Because the one thing the Russians can't stand are niggers. Oh, over here they love them. Go to Russia. The first nigger that dates a Russian girl, unless she's a KGB agent assigned to him, gets put in line. Second time. Go ahead, you've got it. Drugs? No problem. You want drugs? Here's your card. Don't cost you a nickel. Go down to the drugstore and get all you want. No more profit, no more mafia, no more corruption, no more petty crime. Give them what they want. But the first one caught sharing the drug with somebody who doesn't have that card, and you use the Chinese solution, they get shot in the street. China settled its drug problem real quick. It has no drug problem. It ships the drugs here. That's your problem. Strong patriotic government would resolve practically every problem you want to present to us. But it requires a moral society. We say that our race is our nation, and our race is our religion. Because if I believe in God, and God was my maker, and he made me in his image, I only have to look in the mirror to see what race my God is. And if my God says he sent his son to this earth, then his son came from a world to be sent here. And I don't have any doubts about that. Jesus of Galilee, Jesus of Galilee, Galilee, where all the Judaic peoples had been deported 300 years before Christ appeared on the scene. And of the 12 disciples, only one was a non-Galilean, Judas. And the Galileans came from where? From north of the Caucasus Mountains. They were brought to Galilee. And they were a tall people and a fair people, and blue eyes predominated in that part of the land. I don't have any doubts. Because I do believe in my God, and I believe in my race, and I believe in my family, and you're part of my family. You are my brother and sister. They can't kill me, because I believe I lived before, and I will live again, just as you will if you believe it and choose it. I'm going to read to you, in closing, some lines that go way back to the 1880s. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide in strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the bloom or blight, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness and that light. Then to side with truth is noble when we share her wretched crust, ere her cause bring fame and profit, and 'tis prosperous to be just. Then it is the brave man chooses, while the coward stands aside, till the multitude make virtue of the faith they had denied. Count me o'er earth's chosen heroes, they were souls that stood alone, stood serene and down the future, saw the golden beam incline to the side of perfect justice, mastered by their faith divine, by one man's plain truth to manhood and to God's supreme design. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet 'tis truth alone is strong. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet the scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown stands God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. You are his own. Go with God. Victory is ours. Tomorrow truly does belong to us starting today. Thank you.
Well, there was Pastor Robert Miles from Choctaw, Michigan. And he paid the price. He did 10 years in federal prison for resisting racial integration of the schools by symbolically burning up a bunch of school buses. And he did 10 years for that straight time. He never never accepted a parole. What's interesting about this, earlier on, before, by a few years, I had been involved in Identity Christianity and quite a bit, and I knew these leaders around. But when I decided to leave that belief, it's interesting that Robert Miles and Pastor Butler up in Oregon, Aryan Nations, we still got along great. I don't recall we ever had a fight, and that's very rare in this racial struggle. We worked together for years, and now this tape was primarily more the spiritual thing from Robert Miles. Somewhere in this case of tapes, I've got the beginning where he's talking about the Fifth Era Klan and so forth, and strategy and all that kind of stuff. You got a little bit of it there, but not all of it. So one of these days I'll find it. It may not even be marked, so I have to go through them one at a time. Tommy's filing system is not the greatest. Back in the day, I was pretty much a one-man band. I've had people working with me over the years, but through most of it, I was doing everything. So you can imagine me not filing things away properly. Well, here's a partial that goes back to 2002, one of our shows, so get ready. Hold on to your seat.
A copy of our latest newspaper. Now, if you'd like 100 copies of our newspaper, they're $20 per 100, postpaid to your door in a plain brown envelope or package, and 1,000 newspapers to your door in a plain brown box for $100 postpaid. Within the paper, you'll receive a complete list of all the little goodies that this racist outfit in this bunker in Southern California has to send your way. So get at it. That's the way we finance our operations here, is all our little goodies that we sell and some of the donations you send in, and we surely have
a... All right, cut with the ads, Metzger. Cut with the ads.
Being on what we say, we try not to spin. We just give it to you straight, raw racism, revolutionary racism, Joe had enough racism. In almost every voting area in California coming up the election, there is a bond issue to improve the schools and to repair all the old schools. Well, it sounds pretty good. Are you for the kiddies? Of course we're for the kiddies, the white kiddies. The problem is, in the schools where I'm at, there's very few white kiddies left. All the elementary schools are probably about 75% at least non-white or Mexican illegal mestizos, and it's rising rapidly. All you have to do is watch the bus stops around here and watch them unload the buses. So what they want this for is to get all this money to build more buildings and more schools to fill them up with more Mexicans. So let the Mexican government educate the Mexicans, hopefully in Mexico and not up here. We don't want to do that, and so we're saying vote no on L in the area where I live. It may be another letter or number in the area where you live. So guess what? Old terrible Tommy has been taking some time. He painted up a big old billboard, and he's going out on the street corners here in my local town, and I'm standing out there telling people to vote no on Proposition L. Well, you may say, gee, that's not very revolutionary. Well, it feels good to get out there and look these people in the eyeballs. We got a big Mexican sign on this billboard that I'm holding, and it's all crossed out with a black X. So they get the message real fast. We get a few fingers, and they scream at us a little bit, but we're having fun out there, and I'm not afraid to go out on the streets, and I think we all the leaders around this country that talk so much should get out in the streets a little more often and take the flack if they can. And now, to give you an example of our high-quality newspaper, I'm going to read you, and I don't do this too often, that March paper just went out, 2002, and incidentally, this is February 27th, 2002, and this is the editorial for the March paper. Hysterical revisionism, friend or foe. Wow, this could step on a few toes. Your editor has a few qualities of H.L. Mencken.
but does not claim relationship beyond having a knack of stepping on toes, and at the same time gets extreme pleasure at taking pot shots at sacred cows in the ongoing struggle, especially in the right-wing conservative area. To some, the historical revisionist idea has become a holy quest, even though everything they attempt to revise has already happened and serves little cause for today. Give it up. The masses never learn by history and never will. Even the leaders rarely learn by history. Even Uncle Adolf didn't learn a bit from Napoleon's fun and games in Russia. Revising history is as old as history. Perhaps that's what led Henry Ford to exclaim in no uncertain terms, "History is bonk." Certainly we know the first round of history after a great event is left to the winners in whatever arena the event may have been in. The winners always get first crack at that. That is the most important position to be in. System-approved historians trot out to administer the first round of brainwashing known lovingly down on the farm as bullshit. History is like eyewitnesses in a courtroom. Most lawyers will tell you an eyewitness many times is the worst witness. If you don't believe it, place four individuals on four corners of an intersection and then wait for an accident that they all will have a clear view of. Then interrogate each one as to what he or she saw. It will amaze you at the differences in their story. Historians rush as fast as possible to interview eyewitnesses. Since the eyewitnesses could only see a small slice of any great happening, it's like a committee designing a cow blindfolded. Add into that all the personal biases and prejudices, and you come up with perhaps not bunk, but maybe a bucket of eels in most cases. While it may be honest testimony in many cases, they are often honestly wrong. Remember the Jews that testified that the smoke color coming from the crematoria chimneys depended on the nationality of the Jew being cremated? Don't laugh. I believe they honestly believe that. It's no more bizarre than the many women claiming to have been kidnapped by flying saucers and put through various sexual experiments on the Art Bell show. So what about the historical revisionism? Does it somehow help us drown trodden white races in our legitimate struggle for race survival? Perhaps it supplies some of us with R&R after a long, hard day, but its actual effect on our success in the quest for racial survival and expansion is doubtful. Sorry to disappoint you, but if there was a God, he or she is the greatest stand-up comedian of all time. History proves it, as does the morning's headlines. Christian churches being wiped out by tornadoes is one of my favorite cosmic jokes. Most rightist revisionism deals with World War II and Germany. While a form of racial nationalism existed in Germany, it surely was not as deeply ingrained as the American version of racism. Perhaps that was because of the simple fact that most Germans, if not all, were white-skinned. Even most of the Jews that Germany wanted to rid themselves of had white or near-white skin. The desire for race separation was much stronger in the U.S. than in Germany. Just look at our sterilization programs and many other eugenics programs that were in full swing long before World War II. Germany was so devoid of niggers they had to pretend the Slavs were niggers. Most mainstream revisionism has dealt with the evils of racism. On the right, most revisionists are appalled at the thought of real get-down racism because it requires force and possible violence. Oh my gosh! If let go long enough, it could even require genocide. What he said. Most of all, most so-called intellectuals think a lot and read a lot, but getting their hands dirty or even bloody is not their forte. It is true that many white races dabble in revisionism, but at the top, the thinkers consider such people as little more than white trailer trash. They tolerate racists at best, and only then to help finance the operations and warm seats in a very boring conference or two. Almost all the intellectuals I have seen or talked to in the revisionist movement are not racist at all. Some are married to non-whites. Some are homosexual. Some are associated with other larger anti-racist cults. Most are a bit snobbish. I understand the big star David Irving is put off by the average purchaser of his books, along with other quirks. And what's all that about when he sues a Jew and expects to win in a Jew-worshipping court? What about that, David? Even John and I knew we were going to lose in Portland no matter what Perry Mason tricks we could play. The police guards were amazed as we broke down laughing when the decision came in because we knew the fix was in. Come on, David Irving, wise up. Even though Willis Carto may be a person not to be entrusted with your checkbook, as has been proven in several court trials at least, he has caused the publication over the years of Get Down racist material. Below several other layers, one does find a racist and perhaps a Hitler worshiper who was only interested in revisionism as a means to an end. Actually, I can respect that part. Of course, where all the revisionist money went to is another question. Only a small portion so far has turned up. Perhaps Willis is using it to help refinance the aging Odessa network, but I doubt it. The biggest issue with right-wing revisionism is the so-called Holocaust. I do not recall ever hearing a revisionist say that a lot of Jews didn't die in World War II. They and the Jew opposition are content to quibble over a million here or a few hundred thousand there. To a white racist who is watching as his race goes down the drain on a daily basis, I say, so what? Let's just say goody-goody and get on with it. I won't argue 1 minute over the Holocaust issue. We all know what liars Jews at the top are, so leave it to that. What's worse, the Jew establishment has used the revisionist issue as an excuse to produce $100 million movies to ingrain more whites with more and more guilt. They use it to infect the public schools. If we had all said way back that we don't care how many Jews were given Aryan justice, the whole mess would be a tempest in a teapot by now. That guilt program doesn't stop at the Jews either. It initiates guilt into almost every issue that exists. It spills over into the black issue and the mestizo issue and even the Asian issue. Oh, you don't think the Holocaust issue had anything to do with the reparations you paid Japanese who were interned during World War II? Was it $20,000 a head? I think it was. Even though interning them was as much for their safety as to prevent sabotage, imagine what would have happened to the Japanese in metropolitan cities or even small towns if the U.S. forces had been driven back to our own shores or the Japanese had invaded the mainland. Every Japanese that hysterical and angry whites could have gotten their hands on would have been slaughtered in the wildest way. But the massive false guilt that was foisted onto the white population by Jews and Jew worshippers affects all the decisions on such issues. The fact is that people don't feel guilty about something until you tell them over and over and over they're guilty. The right-wing revisionist movement exposes an issue by minimization, and the opposition, who have billions, use it as an excuse to deluge the population with massively orchestrated movie guilt trips. By the time the anti-white Christian churches get done, hysteria is sweeping the country. If you think you will be able to intellectually educate people out of their present understanding of the Holocaust, forget it. They still believe, for the most part, the nonsense about the plagues in Egypt and Moses, or was it the Babylonian version Mises, who was called, oh yeah, in Babylon he was called Nabu, who raised his golf club and parted the Red Sea. Do you believe that crap? They still teach this absurd nonsense in the Christian mind control centers all over this country and other countries, even after a majority of Jews say among themselves it was a crock of crap. Knowing that, how can we, who are fighting for our very lives as individuals and a race, drain tens of millions of dollars away from the racial revolutionary struggle and into a movement that is still trying to prove the Nazis were nicer guys than we thought and clean up Germany's image when the bulk of the Germans are at least as racially suicidal as white Americans? Woody Allen is the best self-hating Jew I know. I've seen all his movies. I've told you before that in one of his films, which at the moment escapes me, a favorite of mine, Max von Sydow, I believe his name is, has been watching TV as his daughter comes home. She asks what he's watching, and he replies, a program about the Holocaust. She then says, well, how could such a thing happen? And Max Sydow calmly says, my dear, the question should not be how it could happen, but why it doesn't happen more often, unquote. Perhaps that should be the preoccupation with revisionism as to why it doesn't happen more often. Who are these upstarts to shock us with horror stories about Hitler being a liberal after all? They're gradually stripping all the reasons away that I thought Uncle Adolf was an ass-kicking guy. Damn, they ruined my whole day. End commentary. And that's the kind of stuff we put in the war paper. Don't sound too much like some of the stuff you read in other even so-called racist papers. So remember, it's $30 a year in the U.S., postpaid, plain brown envelope to your home, $40 in Canada, and $50 to all other offshore nations. So that's it for today. Think white, act white, be white, and kick some ass.
Boy, that guy's a blabbermouth, boy. And I think he used to be more of a blabbermouth than he is now. But sometimes these things sort of revive me a little bit, and I get a little excited. I take a little more geritol, and away I go. Oh, I heard on the left-wing radio, of course I can't hardly keep them separated, it's all a bunch of the lies anyhow. Well, most of it. But they said that the military... I think it was a military newspaper in Europe or someplace, or somehow in the military, there was an article that said that the white nationalists were a greater threat in this country than all these wars were in. Can you believe that? The white nationalists were more dangerous than all these wars in Iraq and all over the place were. That's what they're trying to peddle. But I wish it was true. But you know the shape of the so-called right wing. Yeah. I'm still waiting for more of the left-wing racists to show up. There are a lot of them out there. Yeah. But they don't believe in the Jewish crap either or any of that stuff. But they do believe in taking care of the environment and staying out of war and different things like that, like Jack London believed, and I believe, you know, so. But I haven't seen many of them come out front yet, looking for any way they can, any situation they can, to really come down on people like you and me. They really want us to stub our toe and screw up so they can drag us away. And look how they tried to use that guy that jumped in his car and ran down the hill and ran over a gal down there in Charlottesville. They've been playing that up ever since. They need things like that. And they're going to either set them up or some stupid person is going to do something like that, thinking they're advancing the cause. Have you noticed how many positions Trump has changed 180 degrees on critical things like the Fed? Going for low interest now instead of high interest. And his tax plan is going to benefit the rich in this country, not the middle class or the poor. I heard last night that Fats Domino died from the 50s. And interesting, during the Katrina flood down in New Orleans, they had to rescue him. He was so fat, it took four guys and a rickshaw to take him out of his house. Yeah. Fats Domino, I remember in high school, they came out with a rumor that Fats Domino was dying. This was in 56, 55, and his last song would be Farewell to Teenagers. Fats Domino's gone.
You know, I read this headline, and I immediately thought of you. I had to get you on. The forecast, your forecast is coming true. Okay, so here's the headline. China has apparently created a yuan-priced oil contract immediately convertible into gold. So what's the product? When does it launch? Tell us about the significance of this. If anyone's read your books, including Currency Wars and The Road to Ruin, etc., they know this is right in your wheelhouse. This is Jim Rickard's land. Tell us about it.
First of all, Max, thank you for mentioning those books. And Currency Wars touched on this, and The Road to Ruin, my most recent book, touched on it. But the one title you left out, which actually goes right to this issue, is called The Death of Money. That was my 2014 book. But they all cover the different facets of the international monetary system. And where I get into a lot of controversy, I describe this, I describe the steps, I describe how it's unfolding, and people, seem to have very short attention spans, and they seem to think these things happen overnight, and, so you say something and a day goes by and it doesn't happen, it's like, oh, you're an idiot because it doesn't happen. I said, no, listen to me, this is going to unfold in stages, it's coming, get ready now, what are you waiting for? I actually got a tweet the other day, very nice person said, hey, Jim, can you tell me how I can store my gold in a safe deposit box so I can convert to cash in 3 hours? And I said, first, I don't give individual investment advice. I observe these things, but I don't answer them directly. But just from a general term, I wouldn't put my gold in a safe deposit box because, the time you want your gold the most is when the banks are going to be closed. So there's a conditional correlation there of putting your gold in a place you're not going to be able to get it when you want it. But leaving that aside, the mentality is, hey, Jim, call me the day before and I'll get ready. And I keep saying, no, I'm not going to know the day before. This is going to cascade out of control. You need to get ready now. But specifically to your point, Max, what's happening is this announcement, it was a big deal announcement. I agree with you. We'll explain it for the viewers. But it's really a matter of China cobbling together two or three different things. So some years ago, they launched the Shanghai Gold Exchange. And this is a wholesale physical cash for gold exchange. You can sell them gold. You can buy gold. It's by our standards, actually fairly liberal. I've been to China recently. I've met with the largest gold dealers in China, the ICBC, some of the other banks over there, to talk about this. Then they launched a gold futures contract. We all know what a gold futures contract is. It's paper gold, but you can buy or sell forward. And then, of course, China is the biggest importer of oil in the world, and they buy a lot of their oil from Saudi Arabia and from Russia. Russia is the largest exporter of oil in the world, and of course their currency is the yuan. So you have all these different pieces. You have gold futures, physical gold, yuan, Russian exporting stuff. So all they did in this announcement, they combined all this. They said, okay, here's the deal. You sell us oil, and instead of paying you dollars, and that goes back to the petrodollar deal of 1974, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Let me just finish this explanation. But you sell us oil, we'll pay you yuan. But hey, Russia, Iran's another big oil exporter. You guys say, well, what are you going to do with the yuan? So we'll tell you what. You can convert your yuan spot to gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. So it's as if you sold us the oil for gold. And oh, by the way, if you don't like the exchange risk, you can go to the gold futures market and hedge that risk. So now by combining all these different elements, in effect, we've got a yuan benchmark price for oil. That's a big deal. That's the end of the petrodollar deal. I was actually, my first official visit to the White House was in 1974, and I met with Helen Sonnenfeld, who was Henry Kissinger's deputy. And at that time, what we did, we were discussing what to do about the original oil crisis, which goes back to 1974. Remember, Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard in 1971. That's very well known. But the gold standard didn't end overnight. It was kind of two or three years of stumbling and bumbling. Are we going to have gold? Are we going to devalue the dollar, go back to gold, a new level? France wanted gold. The U.S. did. So there was this whole fuzzy period between 1971 and 1973. But by 1973, the Arabs were fed up because inflation had kicked in. They said, hey, we're not going to sell you oil for dollars anymore because we're not confident in the value of the dollar, and the Arabs were buying gold. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of the Treasury at the time, William Simon, his chief deputy, Gerald Parsky, Kissinger's deputy, Helmut Sonnenfeld, and others, and again, Sonnenfeld is the guy I met with in the White House, what do we do about this? One of the plans, what I was discussing with Kissinger's deputy, was invading Saudi Arabia, establishing a security perimeter, taking over the oil fields, and basically not stealing the money, but just selling it at a price we liked for dollars, and then holding the money in trust for the Saudis, so you can get your money. You know, it'd be like going on Social Security for the whole country. I think it's smart that, that was not the plan that the U.S. pursued. The plan they did pursue was the petrodollar deal, where we said to the Arabs, hey, look, you guys sell us the oil for dollars, and we'll take the dollars and put it in the bank and, in effect, guarantee a stable dollar, and then we'll take the dollars and lend it to people who could buy more oil from you. So it all went around in a circle. That was the original petrodollar deal, with some ups and downs, with, you know, a spike in gold in 1980 and some inflation in the United States from 77 to 1980, 81, etc. There were problems along the way, but that petrodollar deal held until last week. And now we have the yuan, the petro-yuan deal, if you want to call it that. Oil is going to be priced in China's yuan, but the yuan is not a particularly desirable currency, and China's saying, no problem, we'll back it up with gold. Well, that's a reflection of the fact that China spent the last 10 years quadrupling their gold reserves. You couldn't do that deal. You couldn't stand up to the market and say, hey, bring in your yuan, we'll give you gold, unless you had some gold. And China's reserves have gone from about 600 tons in 2006 to officially 1,800 tons, but that's a bogus figure. There's every reason to believe that China has closer to 5,000 tons, perhaps more. It's a little bit of detective work. I do some of it. Others have worked on this problem, but we know Chinese mining output of 450 tons a year. We know Chinese imports through Hong Kong. We know Swiss exports to China. We have enough data, and we know they operate through military channels. By the way, my contacts in the gold dealing community in China confirmed that for me when I was there in Shanghai not long ago. I said, how come you use the army to move the gold around? And he said, we're not allowed to carry guns. I said, yeah, you're right. Because, you know, in the United States, if you try to rob a Brinks armored car, they have guns, but in China, no one's allowed to have guns except the military, so that's why the military's involved. But anyway, put it all together, China probably has more than 5,000 tons, maybe a lot more, and so they're now standing up to the market. They are assuming the role that the United States abandoned in 1971. The problem is we still don't have a fixed price. China is still not, they're saying if you give us yuan, you can get gold. Yes, they're saying that. But it's not at a fixed rate. The price of yuan still floats. The price of gold still floats, denominated in dollars, euros, yuan, or any other currency. So it's still a little sketchy, and their solution is, well, sell the gold forward on the Shanghai Futures Exchange if you want to lock in, let's say, a dollar price or a euro price or any other price. So it's still not a completely rock-solid gold standard, but it's getting really close. We're getting closer and closer to the point where the dollar is like the Mexican peso. It'll be a local currency. If you're coming to New York, you'll need some dollars for, you know, taxi money, but it won't be the leading benchmark global reserve currency. And there I would look for not the yuan so much, but the IMF SDR, the special drawing right.
So, Jim, you know, when countries try to sell oil in something other than the U.S. dollar, the CIA, your buddies, tend to assassinate them. You had Saddam Hussein taken out by the CIA. You had Muammar Gaddafi taken out by the CIA because they try to sell oil, energy, in something other than the U.S. dollar. So are they going to encourage the wrath of the CIA? And by the way, I just checked online to the CIA gift shop, and they do have copies of John Perkins' Confessions of an Economics Hitman for sale, which I thought was kind of ironic. But, Jim, is this going to abide in Langley? I thought that this was the cardinal sin of global finance. Never sell oil in anything but dollars, Jim.
Well, I have no comment on any of that, Max. And, assassination is illegal under U.S. law, and I have no comment on what any particular agency is going to do, but I would observe the following. By the way, I was a little annoyed that the CIA gift shop didn't have my book. I was in the process of talking to them about that, but they do have a very nice bookstore there. I was able to pick up a copy of George Tenet's biography and actually had it autographed by a former CIA director, Tennis. That's another book I keep in my library, my autographed books collection. Look, let's see how it plays out geopolitically. I would the cases you mentioned are interesting in the following sense. I look at them not so much as it relates to gold and dollars, but as it relates to the North Korean nuclear program. Because people say, you know, what's wrong with Kim Jong-un? Is he crazy? He's developing nuclear weapons. He's developing intercontinental ballistic missiles. He's mastered the uranium and plutonium enrichment process. He's mastered a lot of the technology. He's getting close to the point where he can miniaturize the bomb, put it on a warhead, on a missile, and take out not just Seattle or Los Angeles, but Chicago or New York.
All right, Jim, let's follow up on that in another segment. If you can hang on there, we'll do another segment and get into the North Korea. Thanks for being...
Did you know that heroin was invented to cure morphine addiction? Wow, man. Factoid. If you're tempted to watch the latest John Wick movie, which is an action movie, but this one goes crazy. This guy single-handedly shoots down about 50 guys and doesn't get touched. The whole movie is like that. I turned it off. It's on Netflix. Of course, most movies are like that nowadays, that the hero just kills a whole bunch of people without getting a scratch. And that's why a lot of these niggers are getting killed, because they believe that shit and they can point a gun and shoot a guy and shoot 10 guys and they'll all drop dead and he'll be fine.